dead bodies, murky weather, and pretty good food are just some of the elements we explore today as we talk with a couple of authors who are practitioners of a type of fiction I call neo-noir. Stories steeped in all the classic elements of hard-boiled detective thrillers, but with a more modern sensibility. I'm Suzanne Lang, and it's a novel idea. Daniel Pine is not only a novelist, but has many screen credits to his name, is currently the showrunner for the series Bosch, and has worked in Hollywood movies and television for most of his career as a writer. I'll talk with him in just a minute about many things, including his series of novellas called Catalina Eddy, a novel in three decades. Later in the broadcast, we'll hear my conversation with award-winning playwright Stephen Mack Jones, who's just published his first novel, a crime thriller, set in Detroit, August Snow. Stay with us, especially if you are a sucker for crime fiction. It's KRCB's A Novel Idea. You may not immediately recognize the name Daniel Pine, but you may be familiar with his body of work, which includes screenplays and script doctoring for films that include the remake of The Manchurian Candidate, Pacific Heights, Fracture, and White Sands. He wrote and directed the film Where's Marlowe, and he has been involved in several television productions, including his current gig as showrunner for the hit series Bosch. On top of all of this, he is a novelist whose work includes A Hole in the Ground Owned by a Liar, 29 Palms, 50 Mice, and his most recent, Catalina Eddy, a novel in three decades. I spoke with him from Los Angeles, California, in the writer's room for the show Bosch. Here is our conversation. Daniel Pine, welcome remotely to Northern California.
Thank you.
For our listeners, we had this interview scheduled a week ago and had to reschedule for today. And in that ensuing week, I got to binge watch Bosch, which you are the showrunner for. And so we're here to talk about your book, Catalina Eddy, and we're going to talk a lot about that. But I guess I first wanted to ask you about that, about what a showrunner is. And why don't you tell our listeners what a showrunner does?
What a showrunner does. The showrunner on a TV show is basically responsible for everything, with the exception of physical production. We develop the story, we rewrite the scripts, we cut the shows, we make the final decisions on anything involving story or the creative elements of the show. Of course, when you have an ongoing show like Bosch, a lot of those initial decisions have been made, so part of it is just to continue the good work that they've done. But in the new season, in the fourth season, I'm basically responsible for the story. So if it goes south, it's my fault.
Well, I'm only like, I'd say, two-thirds of the way through season three, where I start seeing your name in the credits. So what I noticed in my brief study of Bosch and your involvement with it just through the credits, I noticed that not on every show you have a writing credit. And I also noticed, and for our listeners, Daniel Pine is also a screenwriter and has had many films produced, including The Manchurian Candidate and Pacific Heights, among others. But it also seems like you have written some screenplays that maybe either got into production, but your name's not on the credit, or maybe you did some work on and are uncredited. And I guess I'm wondering how that works, and I'm sure it's very complicated, but when your name is actually, when you're credited with being the writer of either a screenplay or in a show like Bosch.
It's actually, film is by necessity, film and television are by necessity collaborative mediums. So on Bosch, we have 5 writers to write 10 episodes. So each writer last season I was not the showrunner. I was just an executive producer. I was sort of under the showrunner. And each person is responsible for writing their own episode, which is where my credit would appear. But all of us are involved before the season begins in sort of breaking the season and figuring out what the major storylines are and who the major characters are and what the major twists are. And then we break that down into episodes in what they call a writer's room. And then people go off and they write their individual episodes based on the outline that we've created in the room. And similarly, in features, since the beginning of time, there is this tradition of occasionally having a screenplay that someone writes, and then they're not available to do more writing on it by the time the production comes together, or perhaps the production and the writer and the director have a creative parting of ways, so they hire another writer to come in. And you've heard the term script doctor, which is basically someone who comes in on an existing project and makes changes and hopefully makes it better. And the decision on who gets credit ultimately in a screenplay especially is decided by 3 writers. We have an arbitration process where writers will read all the different drafts of the script and they'll decide who deserves credit based on a WGA formula that, you know, occasionally rewards the wrong person, but generally is fair and everyone agrees with it. So it means that I have done a lot of work on projects that I got no credit on. It means that I've gotten credit on projects that I had very little to do with in the end. It's just the nature of the job. It's one of the reasons why I like writing books, because nobody comes in and rewrites me, and I'm not rewriting somebody else. It's all my work.
And we're going to get to your life as a novelist.
I mean, I've been really lucky in screenwriting and in television, but in screenwriting especially, I've rarely had to be replaced. I don't do a lot of rewriting, so I pick and choose. I try to do it when it seems right. But I've been very lucky. I've been able to work with a lot of really good directors, and they keep me on for the whole project. So,
and I guess I'm wondering if it's really a smaller world than we might think. Working in Los Angeles, working in Hollywood, being a script doctor or working with directors, is it a fairly small world?
It is. It's pretty small. And it fluctuates. You know, you can be in favor for a while and then you sort of fall out of favor, or the directors and the producers that you work with either age out or aren't making as many projects, or people get tired of you and they replace you. So there's a constantly shifting handful of people who are doing a lot of that kind of work. In television, it's a much bigger field, but you have TV shows that have these staffs of 5 to 10 writers who write all the shows. And it's not, I think the Writers Guild is the smallest of the creative guilds in Hollywood. So it's not a huge group. It's in thousands, but it's not huge.
Because I know a lot of people are out there writing screenplays, hoping they'll get made into movies. And I think there are probably screenwriters who have fairly good reputations as writers, but maybe never get a project seen to fruition.
Yeah, it's true. It's true. It's a classic story. You'll have people who have been reasonably successful and have, but their actual credits, the things that you see if you look them up, are few.
And for you, as a writer, as a maker, as a creator, and you have these four novels, isn't it?
Now, yeah.
It seems that the way you would approach writing for each project is very different. Well, maybe not very different. You're creating story, narrative, plot, characters, but the telling of that story is through really a different medium, and the medium of a novel is the reader's head, you know. So what are for you the specific challenges and satisfactions about working in these different forms as a writer?
The biggest challenge for me in making the transition from film to prose was that in film, you only can know what you see and hear. You can only know about a character through their behavior, through their dialogue, through what other people say about them. And in a book, you can go inside somebody's head and you can describe what someone is thinking. In a movie, you have to move them through the room and hope that the way the performance develops tells you what's going on inside of their head. And occasionally they might be able to tell you what's going on in their head. But a lot of times it's a little bit of an opaque medium. And you learn to tell story through gesture and through visuals and through, you know, through editing, through a combination of images that when put in sequence tell you a story. Books are so much more fluid. And it's difficult for me because that process of writing for film, you tend to tell a story in a relatively linear way. And in a book, you can jump around, you can go backwards, you can tell the story for a while, and then the character can remember something that's very important that happened in the past, and you can tell that entire story. In that respect, they're very different.
And it sounds like for you that moving into novels, and it sounds like you started out screenwriting first, that maybe it affords you a little bit more freedom in telling a story.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. What happened to me was I came out of college thinking that I wanted to write fiction, whatever that meant, and I got an opportunity to just sort of through chance and circumstance, I got the opportunity to start working in television and film. So I did that, and the added benefit for me was, nobody really cares how well written a screenplay is in terms of the actual writing of it. But I learned that in the same way that you can entice a reader and you can create images in a reader's head, part of the art of a screenplay, especially a screenplay before the movie is made, that's getting everyone to agree to make the movie, part of the art of that is to create the same kind of story so the person who's reading your screenplay sees the movie. They read the words, but they see the movie. And that's kind of how I approach storytelling. And it did kind of free me up because I was able to experiment with some storytelling styles and some prose styles in the dialogue and description in my screenplays without fear of, you know, a fiction editor slamming me early on. I think I also just became a better writer by doing dramatic writing. I had to write with a lot more concision. My action and description had to be very concise because screenplays don't tolerate a lot of that. So I learned how to describe things with very few words.
Well, what I've noticed about your novels is that you obviously take a real delight in language. And yeah. And
I do.
So
yeah.
That makes the reading of it fun. Yeah.
I'm glad. Yeah, I have I have this weird schizophrenic writer's personality where some of my favorite writers are great stylists like Joyce and Pynchon and Faulkner and David Foster Wallace. And then at the same time, some of my favorite writers are just great, simple storytellers, powerful storytellers like Faulkner and Raymond Chandler and Dashiell Hammett and people who aren't, they're stylists in a different way. And I've been trying to learn how to find a middle ground between those two things without over-describing, without pushing people out of the story with, you know, my attempts at poetic language, but at the same time not succumbing to the temptation to just write hard-boiled, simple description like a lot of pop novelists.
Yeah, and I think that sometimes that is a challenging line because sometimes overly descriptive language, as you put it, can really push you out and distract from, like, when I have to reread a sentence more than once, And not just because I enjoyed it, more like because what's going on here? You know, that's a problem. So your latest book is Catalina Eddy, and something that is in your, I would say, your Southern California fiction is weather. And I'm wondering, and maybe you could tell our listeners what Catalina Eddy is.
Yeah, it's not a book about Catalina, and it's also not a book about a guy named Eddy. It's the Catalina Eddy is the weather phenomenon that creates what Southern Californians call June gloom, which often stretches from May to September. But it's that weather pattern where it's gray in the morning and then it burns off around noon, and it's sunny and windy in the afternoon, and then it repeats itself again and again and again. And I've lived down here for a long time, and it kind of occurred to me that that was an interesting phenomenon, that this went on and on, that this was, and it was the same. I can, in the same way that I grew up in Denver and we had real seasons, I can recognize the seasons through this weather pattern that seems infinitely the same. And then that kind of interested me because I was also doing, I was sort of toying around with these stories that are all crime stories, and they're all Southern California crime stories, and they take place in different eras, but they all sort of, they seemed like they shared a certain rhythm. And in the same way that lots of crime books written in the 20th century and beginning of the 21st century have a certain common language. And I was just interested in that. So I set the three novellas in Catalina Eddy all in June. So they're all the characters are dealing with this June gloom weather pattern. And it's the same in all three books, even though the plots and the characters are all different. I don't know. It's just sort of, I like organizing principles like that. I've always liked it in film, and I really like it in storytelling. I like finding odd connections between place, character, and place.
And that's part of the satisfaction of this book. And as you just mentioned, for our listeners and our readers, Catalina Eddy is a novel in three decades. And the stories aren't directly related, but there are threads that kind of echo through the stories, and
there's a kind of yeah, character thread. There's a kind of history that plays itself out between characters, between eras, that has nothing to do really with the plot.
In some ways, I thought that added some depth to it and made for the reality that you were creating just that more connected, more real and believable in crime fiction, you know, is it believable or not? And now you're working on a show that deals a lot with crime and detectives and certainly noir, neo-noir crime fiction deals with a lot of nasty people who do stupid things. Mm-hmm. And sometimes I wonder if, are there really that many serial killers out there? Or is this just a way of that we like being entertained? And especially now within the headlines, you know, corrupt cops. Yes, there are cops out there shooting people every day. We have, you know, a political administration that we're living in a reality TV show. So I don't know. It interests me what the nexus is there between, you know, this kind of classic form of fiction, but that more and more we're entertained by this sort of thing in reality.
It's been interesting working on Bosch. I wasn't really looking to get back into television or to do this job particularly, but I've always been kind of a fan of Michael Connelly's books, and one of the things that appeals to me about this show that sort of overlaps with my where I'm going with fiction writing is I really like grounding stories in a very tangible reality. I like the messiness of a of real life, and then trying to sort out meaning from that rather than the kind of neat heightened realism or super realism of some kinds of crime stories. And one of the things that Michael Connelly does so well in his books is they're extremely well researched. He talks to cops all the time, and a lot of the incidental things that happen in his books are very much based in the everyday reality of the cops that he uses as advisors. And similarly, on the show, we have two technical advisors who are working homicide cops, and we have them come in almost every week, and they talk to us about what really happens. And we ask them, in terms of our stories, well, what would really happen? Not what do we want to have happen, but if you were faced with this situation, what would really happen? And as you say, one of the most interesting things to me about the difference between cop shows and real life is one of these homicide cops had a partner who never even brought his gun. He kept it in his desk. You know, this fantasy that you have cops and they're on the street and they're shooting at people all the time just is not true. Yes, there's a lot of gun violence. Yes, there's a lot of bad stuff going on in a country of 300 million people. Probably not proportionally that much. I think that television fiction sometimes does a disservice because it creates a mythology that makes the country and the world seem a lot more dangerous than it is, and it makes the solutions seem more simple than they are, because ultimately in a lot of crime shows, the solution at the end is the good guy shoots the bad guy and the problem is solved. We're trying to examine that, and in my books, I'm trying to examine that, you know, where violence figures into our mythology. One thing that does fascinate me about crime and about cops, and it's why I went down this road for this novel, is that they're just people who are, you know, ordinary people put in the extraordinary position of having to enforce laws that not everybody wants to abide by or be restricted by, and they have to do that job. We've assigned them that, and what does that do to you?
Yes.
Michael Connelly also has this thing that he likes to say, which I think is kind of applies in a larger way to fiction and storytelling, which is he likes to write stories where the case works the detective rather than the detective working the case. And I think that applies to a lot of good storytelling, where it's not so much that you have a character, you know, defining what the story will be, but a character faced with circumstances that he or she has to rise to and overcome or resolve, or, you know, the case works you rather than the other way around. Life works you rather than the other way around.
So in Catalina, Eddie, we have these three decades covered, and I wasn't sure if I was imagining it or if it was actually what you were trying to achieve, but I felt like the writing, the way you were telling the story was even somehow distinguished from the first chapter set in the 50s that I felt had a more of a, I'm going to say, a noirish kind of drive to it. And by the time we get to the third section, which is Portuguese Bend, which is set more in contemporary times, that I felt a contemporary drive and pace to it. Now, I don't know if I was maybe imagining that or if...
No, that's very good. You're the first person who's got that. That was very purposeful. The story in 54 is more the familiar noir tone. I was trying to split the difference between Raymond Chandler and Ross McDonald and write a character who kind of falls between Philip Marlowe and Lou Archer. So it was very much in that genre and that. And I was just kind of twisting it a little bit and trying to set it more completely in the 50s. And then the next novella, Loser Town is set in San Diego in the 80s, and I very much wanted to start to deconstruct the way the story unfolded. It's a kind of unresolved tale. Things don't turn out the way anybody expects them to. It doesn't have a classic noir structure, multiple characters, and the tone of it, it starts to get a lot different. And then, Portuguese Bend was my attempt at finding a new noir, sort of a more modern. It's still noir, but the language and the images and the tone of it is contemporary. It's an attempt at being 21st century.
My experience of reading it was that. At least you
That's
and I
great.
Did it. And I also, the music in this book is something that there is a soundtrack to the book. And I wonder if you listen to music when you write or what?
I used to more. Part of the way that I learned to write screenplays was to think of them in musical terms. Learning to structure was really difficult for me at first. My stories tended to wander, and I started to try to think of them more like, not so much symphonic, but just having a musical structure, and also the rhythms of language. Language to me has a real musical quality when it's done well. Just reading stuff sometimes when it tumbles. I love when I read a story and I don't stumble over anything. It's just tumbling along, and the words are, they sort of tickle me with the sound of the word, even as much as the meaning of the word. And then on top of that, I sort of wanted to get a feel for the Los Angeles that I've come to know, which started in the 50s. You know, the LA jazz scene was a big thing. I do like jazz and Central Avenue, and there was a huge West Coast jazz scene that kind of died in the 60s, and then there's also a big Spanish influence, a big Mexican music influence that comes across the border, and then, I don't know, music just sort of occurs to me as I'm writing. It evokes, I love the use of, the really good use of music in film. I love what it can do and play with images and play against them or with them. So it's probably a reflection of that. It probably comes out of my film world. And I listen to music when I write sometimes.
Well, and one of your characters, Lily, is a singer.
Is a jazz musician, yeah, a singer.
And we remember her really throughout the book. Also, I noticed that again, we're talking about Catalina Eddy, a novel in three decades, and we're talking with Daniel Pine, its author. Did you set out, first of all, to write this as a novel in three decades, or were these kind of independent stories that then you were seeing? Oh, I could structure this way.
I had these, the way that I sort of collect stories without knowing quite what I'm going to do with them, whether they'll be, are they a screenplay, and I collect them over a long time. And these were three stories that haunted me. I didn't really want to write a standalone crime novel set in one decade about one character. So I had these three stories wandering around that I wasn't sure what to do with. And I was noodling on all of them and just suddenly realized, well, this is kind of cool because they're taking place in different time periods. They're all about Southern California. They all evoke a certain feeling. There's some similarities in them. And then I started to correlate things. I mean, in each of the stories, there's a person who's been damaged, who's been crippled and has to deal with it. In each of the stories, there's a main character who is lost. You know, just those kinds of things, and trying to thread things through in the way that life kind of develops in yes. real time. But once I came up with this idea, I thought it would be interesting to write three longer stories and connect them in a way. Faulkner wrote this kind of minor novel called Knight's Gambit about one of his characters, and it's pretty much it's pretty much a crime novel, but it's three stories. It's set in Yaknapatawpha County in Jefferson, and it's about Gavin Stevens, who is the prosecutor who's in Sanctuary, who's a main character in several of the other stories. And it's just, I think it's three or four mysteries. It's short stories that he collected together into a book. And that kind of inspired me to do, I always liked reading those stories, and I wanted to do something not similar, but in the same vein, where I could take three stories like this and mm-hmm. intertwine them.
Yes. And you mention damaged characters and crippled characters, and indeed in the last novella, there is a character who becomes crippled. I was struck with how you expressed her drive, her sense of reality, her frustration, and I noticed in the acknowledgments that you got some consultation on that. And so what was that experience like, writing about a character who goes through something like that and the drive she exhibits throughout the story?
It was difficult at first because it's not something I've experienced, and I was just lucky to run into through a friend. I met a young actress who had been in an automobile accident when she was 16 or 17, and we met and had coffee and sort of became friends, and I told her this idea and started asking her questions about her experience. And it was great because, again, it was one of those things where I didn't want to do what had always been done. I thought, I want to do this in a different way. I want to express what this character is going through. I don't believe it's the melodrama that I've read before, especially then combining it with a police officer who is largely, she's larger than life. She's kind of an active character who is suddenly wheelchair bound. And Teal, the young woman who talked to me, was really great because the way she talked about her injury, it was just one day I'm this way and then the next day I'm not, and I just adjust. And I don't know if that's everyone's experience, but it really helped me to get into the head of somebody who was able to overcome what happened to her and doesn't even think of it so much as a disability as just a challenge. You know, she knows what's going on, but it's, as she would say, I can't do anything about it. I can't change it. One of the small details that's in the book was she told me that, I said, well, how did you, what's this moment when they tell you you can't walk again? What's that like? And she said, nobody ever really told me that. The doctors don't do that. That's not how they do it. They tell you that you've had this injury and that you're paralyzed, and they don't know, because the truth is, yeah, the odds are against you, but anything can happen. They don't know right away. They don't know how the nerves will reconnect. So she said she never had that moment where she dove into it. She just kind of, oh, now I've got to adjust to this. Maybe I'll get better. Maybe I'll get feeling back. And then the longer you go on, the more you realize, well, that's not going to happen, but I can do this. And by the time you get to that point, you have already moved beyond it. It was fascinating to me. It was really helpful. She was really generous in sharing her experiences.
As you mentioned, that character, Riley, is a cop. And what's really driving her is, of course, her desire for independence, but also the case and some things she observed, and really seeking justice. It's almost like her being wheelchair-bound was an inconvenience, but it wasn't going to get in her way.
No, she's still acting. She got married. She was determined to go on, to do what she could do, to continue to pursue the things that she loved.
Yes.
It was fascinating. It was really inspiring.
Also, there in that same story, there's a photographer who does crime scene photographs. And these two characters have, it's not a heavy dialogue, but threaded throughout that story is a conversation about the nature of photography. And I wondered if you wanted to comment on that.
That's kind of another long-term interest of mine. Probably, again, it intersects with my interest in film and visual storytelling. But just the nature of pictures, the nature of documenting, how you change something just by photographing it, what a photograph means, and especially in terms, I would sort of put it in the terms of an investigation into what happened, into a mystery. When you freeze time, do you look at it differently? Do you suddenly see things that you wouldn't see if you were there in real time? Do you see new things that you didn't see at the time? You know, there was a little bit of that. There was a little bit of the compromise that's always involved in art, where this is a character who is an artist. He's a photographer, and he wants to do art photography, but his job is to photograph in the most basic way, the most unadorned way, these violent crimes and these crime scenes and these details that ordinarily he's just documenting. You know, there's no art to it. There doesn't seem to be any art to it, but he tries to find something in it. His eye is so good that he
does both. Sees it too. She sees the art in it, art in it too.
Yeah.
So, Daniel Pine, thank you so much for talking with us today. And I want to mention your other books as well, 50 Mice, 29 Palms, and A Hole in the Ground Owned by a Liar. All good reads. So thank you so much.
And thank you.
I will look forward to continued binge watching on Bosch. I have to finish season 3, and I will look forward to assessing the changes you bring to season 4 as your full season as
4.
Showrunner.
Yeah, it's great fun. It's great fun. I'm working with a great group of people, both on the production side and in the writing room. So it's a joy, and it's a nice, you know, it's a nice change of pace from sitting alone in your room thinking of stories and characters.
I bet. And are you doing some of that too?
This last year, I started working on another book, but this year so far, I've been a little too busy to get back to it. So I have about 100 pages of something that presumably I'll get back to. But doing this job, I take it seriously, and it kind of consumes you. You're basically trying to create a 10-hour movie, so you have a lot of things to think about and a lot of moves and plot to hold in your head.
Well, congratulations on that and on the publication of Catalina Eddy. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
My conversation with Daniel Pine. And his latest book is Catalina Eddy, a novel in 3 decades. We'll take a short break with some music from Detroit area singer-songwriter Jessica Hernandez and the Deltas. We'll then hear my conversation with Stephen Mack Jones, who hails from Detroit, Michigan, on his book August Snow, which is set there. I'm Suzanne Lang with a novel idea.
Hunt you down, going nowhere, no place left to hide. Hunt you down, going nowhere, time ain't on your side. Walls come down, hands up, drop down, know just what I'd find. Walls come down, hands up, drop down, no place left to hide. Walls come down, ends up, drop down, know just what I'd find. Walls come down, ends up, drop down, no place left.
That was Detroit area artist Jessica Hernandez and the Deltas with No Place Left to Hide from her album Secret Evil. She's got a distinctive voice and a keen intelligence. A review in the Huffington Post says, when she walks onto a stage, you know she has a unique point of view. Stephen Mack Jones is a poet, award-winning playwright, and recipient of the prestigious Kresge Arts Fellowship. His first novel is the crime fiction August Snow. Set in contemporary Detroit, the character of August Snow is an ex-cop who has been drummed out of the police force by corruption in the ranks. The son of a black father and a Mexican mother, he returns to his home neighborhood in Detroit, which has fallen subject to the decay and trauma of the rest of the city. Here is our conversation.
Stephen Mack Jones, wish you were here with us and hope you'll be in Northern California soon. Thanks for talking with us today.
Oh, absolutely. Thank you.
August Snow is your recently released crime fiction and set in the city of Detroit.
Yes.
And we'll talk about the book in just a moment. You yourself, as an author, have written poetry and plays, and now this book. Each one of these literary forms really requires maybe a different manifestation of language and pacing and how the narrative flows. And for you as the author, what are some of the challenges and pleasures about these different forms?
That's a great question. I started out reading and writing poetry, and I think, at least for me, that it proved to be one of the best ways of learning the beauty, the wonder, and the imperative of language. In junior high, way, way back, I was reading Pablo Neruda and Octavio Paz and Langston Hughes, Gwendolyn Brooks, and poetry just taught me how to condense language to its most potent form. I love the lessons that reading and writing poetry taught me. And being one who likes to converse and explore how people discover each other, that led me to playwriting. I'm interested in the dynamics of dialogue, what they reveal about each character, and what they don't reveal. Not to mention, I just enjoy theater. And from there, writing this novel, it all led to this novel.
I would imagine that in then writing a novel that you have dialogue, but you also are creating an imaginative setting for the reader that requires a lot of nuanced description.
Yes, yes, absolutely. In writing this novel, one of the characters is Detroit.
Yes.
Fleshing out that character. What is the personality of the city that washes over and through the characters? And I think you might find that in a number of cities, how they affect people, the psychology, the spirituality, how that city impacts various aspects of that person or those people.
And the story is set in Detroit and parts of Michigan, which for a non-Michigan reader, I found, I love books where I go to Google Maps and start looking at the terrain and the geography.
Yeah.
And I grew up in Cleveland, and so Detroit has always okay. been kind of a counter city in a way to us, and certainly suffered some of the same kinds of trajectory.
Right.
But nothing like Detroit, really. And I think that your book is really a crime thriller, but you do talk about
in the book, so much of the social and cultural and economic intersection is revealed, but not in a preachy or way. It really is just part of the background of the story, but you can't ignore it. You just can't ignore it, and it makes it very contemporary.
The relationship that I think most people in Detroit have with the city, and certainly August Snow has with his city, is that of the city being your best frenemy. You love it. There are aspects of it that you love that have just seeped into your soul. And then there are aspects that just aggravate you, just frustrate you. But you know that 100 miles away from that city, 200 miles, 1,000, you know that you are carrying that city in your heart, in your mind, how you react to situations. And I think that's one of the reasons why August came back to Detroit after leaving for a while.
Well, let's talk about August. August Snow is the main character of the book, who is a former cop who has essentially been kind of drummed out of the department and gets a big cash settlement and then travels the world by his own
pretty much
getting drunk.
Right, pretty much in an effort to die from cirrhosis of the liver, drinking too much.
But really, he's a good man at heart, so he can't. He can't seem to pull that off. And comes back home.
Yes.
His father was a cop, a black cop, and his mother was Mexican, and he grew up in a place called Mexican Town. And I thought that was interesting because I think we don't think of Detroit as being a hub of a Mexican community.
It's incredible that a number of people don't see Detroit as a hub of Mexican-American activity, because soon after African-Americans moved north to the cities, because Henry Ford and Dodge and everyone else, but primarily Henry Ford, was offering a great wage, didn't matter what color you were, in the 30s and 40s, right on the heels of African Americans moving north to get some of those good jobs in the auto factories, Mexican Americans were right there also. So Mexican Americans have always been a good and proud presence in the state of Michigan, and especially in Detroit.
Well, the economy of Detroit has changed quite a bit over the last 40 years. And I have this view of when Mitt Romney was running for president, him visiting his maybe boyhood home or something like that, was not in the condition that he lived in it. And that could have been an opportunity for him to somehow make this kind of economic disparity, this kind of urban decline.
Rekindle the spirit.
Yes. But he seemed to be accepting of the fact that that house might just be torn down and that was it.
Yes.
And I think even now when we see some of what's going on, like in Flint, you have to just wonder when. Well, maybe you could tell me from an insider's perspective of somebody who lives there, is there a tangible movement that you can feel to revitalize that area, and is the economic base somehow changing?
It's my opinion that the economic base is changing. There is a rebirth of spirit in Detroit, and there's a rebirth of business opportunity, artistic opportunity in Detroit. A lot of great things are happening in Detroit. The core of the city, the business core of the city, hasn't seen a revitalization like this in 20, 30 years, 40 years. It is just amazing. On the other hand, there's still the challenges of dilapidated neighborhoods. While there is this great revitalization, some of the same problems linger. It's odd because I think a number of people outside of Detroit are seeing this strange revitalization, and they're hearing from a very vocal new population in Detroit, and I shouldn't say new, but expanding population, and that is the artist community, which has expanded incredibly so. Artists are coming here from all over, New York, California, Denmark, Germany, and they're finding great opportunity here.
Getting back to your book, in a way, August Snow jumps back into this environment. And it also sounds like there's a good culinary base as well, because there's a lot of food you talk about and good restaurants in the book.
You know, you cannot talk about the Mexican town area of Detroit without talking about the offerings of great Mexican cuisine. It's just impossible to separate the two. There are a number of great restaurants in Mexican town. Detroit overall has seen an incredible increase in restaurant offerings. Everything from fine dining to pop-up restaurants. It's amazing. But even with that said, my vote is start your culinary tour in Mexican town. Suzanne, one other amazing thing is just recently, the world's best vodka was voted. There was a vote on the world's best vodka. It's made in Detroit. Valentine Vodka. We have a Mexican-American family that lives in Detroit. They own a tire shop, but they also produce an award-winning tequila from their farm in northwestern Mexico. Detroit is a city full of surprises. It's not the stereotype that you would see on the evening news.
And I think that that is, to me, part of what your book does. August is he is a compelling character that is really the driving force in the book, and he's got a lot of incidental characters around him, but you're in his head. His affection for his home place in Mexican Town and his kind of assessment of the world around him is really, to me, the driver of the book, and makes for Detroit becoming a place of interest.
For all of the action and intrigue of the story, I think one of the compelling aspects, at least I tried to make one of the compelling aspects of August Snow, the city, how it is emerging, how it is struggling from the stereotypes of yesteryear, and how also important the influence is of family. Because a lot of what drives August are the teachings of his father, and the teachings and love of his mother. So those are important aspects in the character of August Snow.
Yes, he talks about them frequently, though they're both deceased.
Yes.
And he also, as several of the other characters, are veterans of recent wars. And I too thought that that brought something very real to the character and maybe contributes to his ability to do what he does in the book. But I just felt that this book has a, I'll call it a classic feel of the kind of noirish thriller aspect, but with that contemporary feel that makes all the characters rather relatable, though the situations are extreme. Part of what has created the decline over the years in Detroit, Cleveland cities in the Northeast have been greed, corporate greed. And that's something that I think the book touches on as well. So I think you must have had a lot of fun writing this book.
I did. It was a lot of fun. And you know, people, sometimes people who write grouse about the writing and revision process. And wow, revisions only make a story better. Sometimes you lead the story, other times the story leads you. So, I did have fun writing it.
Maybe might we have future experiences with August Snow?
Well, I am working on a second book, a second August Snow adventure in the city of Detroit. So hopefully we'll see that soon.
Well, we'll look forward to that. Stephen Mack Jones, I'm glad we plowed through technology to have the opportunity to have this conversation. And thanks so much for spending the time with us today.
And I can't thank you enough, Suzanne.
My conversation with Stephen Mack Jones from his home in northern Michigan. His book is August Snow. Earlier in the show, we heard from Daniel Pine with his latest fiction, Catalina Eddy, a novel in three decades. I am Suzanne Lang, and I bring you conversations with writers. Interviews are recorded at the studios of KRCB Public Media with production assistance from Anthony Garcia, Sean Knight, and Mark Prell. This is a Lit Radio production. Thanks for listening. Thank you.